Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of a popular blog, Juggling Dynamite, and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Hey, Jim. Thank you.
Danielle, the IMF, other financial bodies all screaming recession, recession, recession. But locally, I don't see any signs of it. There's still help. There are still help wanted signs everywhere. And of course, people are putting on their websites, can you find me this kind of person? We're desperate for staff. It doesn't sound or look like a recession. Is this time different?
Well, that data can be very local and varied depending on the population dynamics in a particular spot, and also coming after the pandemic, of course, we have some disruptions in typical, people that were working in a local economy have in some cases been employed online, for a company that's, located somewhere else, and so that's left some holes in some of the demand or the availability of local labor. So we have a bunch of dynamics that are going on there, but in the macro data that we follow, the hours worked is actually being cut. The pace of hire has been cut dramatically, and major companies are now talking about the plans for layoffs coming in 2023, if not earlier, because some have already started. So I guess, the anecdotal stuff, as I say, there's various factors at work there. And some of the lower paid manual work, again, if those people have found work online or, virtually, they may not be available in local markets. But overall, it seems that the employment conditions are deteriorating and the demand for labor is weakening.
A headline that caught my eye from your website, self-dealing is rampant. That's where government members and regulatory officials who make all the policies and regulations surrounding trading are actually trading things that they actively influence. Should that be allowed?
Well, of course not. And it's, we know very well that type of pecuniary interest skews one's objective decisions, whether you like to think of it, whether you like to think you're immune or not. We know from centuries of experience with this sort of thing that there should be rules to preclude one from having a personal interest or benefit in a decision they have to make on a policy basis on behalf of the people they represent. So it's, for example, in the legal system, we know very well that there are, these requirements for lack of bias in decision makers. And so we have had in Canada for certain, through the rule of law for centuries, we have had very clear policies and rules around how to prevent both bias and the apprehension of bias. And those are essential to the fundamental operation of the rule of law in a democratic society. And when you contaminate those basic principles, what you do is you degrade the respect and integrity of the entire system, and therefore the likelihood that people are going to follow the rule of law. If they perceive that some people are getting off and allowed to break all the rules and not have any repercussions, and even more so actually financially benefit from breaking these basic ethical principles, it's quite a disaster for the overall society. So the Wall Street Journal, which of course is a very pro-business, pro-markets publication, they've just completed a major investigation into, in this case, in the U.S., although we have various versions of this also worked into Canada in the last, you know, 15 years, where this idea that, everything goes in, you know, free markets and no one should be precluded from self-dealing. So it's really a breakdown. It needs to be reined in hard. And as I say, the Wall Street Journal just itemized 2,600 officials and agencies that work for various, you know, Commerce Department, Treasury Department. And it didn't matter, by the way, whether they were Republican or Democratic or Democrat. They, both sides were, just thick as thieves in terms of making decisions that would have a direct impact on their own financial health. We saw this with the heads of the central bank, by the way, who some of the, you know, the governors actually stepped down last year, if you recall, when they were caught trading or front-running the decisions the Fed was making. And they got away with it. They got to keep their profits, and they bowed out, and they didn't even have to sell. Because they retired or stepped down in advance of the deadline. So it's just, it's a mosh pit. It's a total mess. It's one of the reasons that we've had such extreme excesses and why we're in the midst of yet another, you know, massive equity and asset bubble burst worldwide, and why we're going to have another really bad downturn, I think, balance sheet recession. It's partly because it was aided and abetted by all these bad policies.
Of course, if they're the regulators and the people who make the legislation, how do you clean them out?
Well, that you just have to have a very clear set of rules, not complex, you know, volumes of all sorts of opacity, but you need to have that just says if you're going to be making, you're going to have this policy position, you can't have, you know, blind trust is a way that we've set it up for all kinds of people for years. It's quite well known how you do it. It's just that it hasn't been enforced. And so as a result, it's just become overgrown with this self-dealing behavior. So it's, you know, we've got a similar problem right now. We had it in Canada, for example, in the real estate sector, right? With why have we had such policies geared at blowing the asset bubbles in real estate? Well, partly because policymakers had, you know, whether they were local municipal councillors or provincial regulators, bodies, politicians, they all had, you know, several real estate properties or rental properties or investment properties. They had a lot of the things that were, you know, going up in the bubble that they were aiding and abetting through their policy decisions. And so, again, if you're going to be in that position, you have to put that kind of stuff in a blind trust so that you're not actively making your own financial decisions based on the decisions you're making on a policy basis. We just have to separate the two. And when we don't do that, we end up with just a complete mess, as I said, which is where we are today. And, you know, we've got these groups now coming out lobbying against the central banks raising interest rates, right? We have a bunch of so-called protests and things, petitions making the rounds of demanding that central banks step in now and do something to help homeowners or people who levered themselves highly into real estate in the last number of years and who are now hurting so badly because their entire paychecks or income is being engulfed by the, you know, the tripling of interest rates and the expense on their mortgages and their other expenses for operating properties. But, you know, no one was complaining when the prices were going up 50% in a matter of 2 years, which was bonkers and unsustainable. They're only complaining now that they've been caught flat-footed, right? So that now that they, you know, they're saying, we did nothing wrong, we were just in it trying to invest and get ahead. Well, actually, you did do something wrong if you over-levered at record lows in interest rates, thinking that interest rates would not go up. Now, I agree policymakers are implicated in this as well, because they came out with really dumb statements like, oh, you know, we won't put rates up for the foreseeable future, or, you know, whether it was Janet Yellen, the head of Treasury, saying she didn't see any financial crisis developing in her lifetime. Like, these kind of statements are just so obviously naive and, you know, unworthy of anyone that's educated or intelligent in this area. You know, high leverage begets financial crisis. You can set your watch by it. It'll happen every time. It has throughout centuries, and it's happening now. And so, yes, people did do something wrong when they levered up too much and were trying to, you know, participate in the upside of an asset bubble. And the payback is that you are also participating typically in the bust of that asset bubble. And that's what's happening now. So, of course, everyone wants a bailout when they start losing, but they want to keep the profits when it's going up. So this is the dynamic that we deal with in human nature, and we all tend to be self-interested in the choices that we make. That's all fine and well, but adults have to also own the repercussions of their choices and learn from their mistakes. And that's the piece that's been really missing the past number of years.
The push to get people back to work in the office instead of in their home, how is that working out? And our company's finding out, maybe a hybrid's the best way, so new people can find out, you know, how the whole company works, especially the people hired over the last 2 years who maybe just work from home and never in an office.
I think it's really dependent on the business and dependent on the sector. I mean, we're seeing, you can see that there's some companies where they're, they came out with a strong back to work mandate and then have softened that as there's been resistance. So I think it's a question of how much technical ability they need in the workforce and whether that workforce is willing to come back into the office. What you're also seeing, though, as we head into this recession and the layoffs start to rise, that the chance of laying off people who are working from home as opposed to the ones that are in the office, a lot of studies are showing that it's actually higher to be laid off if you're out of sight, out of mind sort of thing than working, you know, maybe alongside your managers or executives on a daily basis. So I think, you know, there's been a sort of a boldness or a overconfidence in the workforce, just as there was in the investor class in the past couple of years, while they had so much support from governments and while the pandemic gave everyone an excuse to sort of have new work habits. But what you're going to see as labor becomes a slacker, and we've been in a period where labor has been very tight, if labor becomes slacker, and it is as layoffs mount here and the economy turns down, and this is global, don't forget, so what's happening is that there's going to be a sort of a sobering up of people who really either lose their job in this environment or are cut back in terms of the hours they're working, and they're trying to, you know, obviously keep employed through a very difficult recession and downturn in the global economy. So I think that people will become more compliant or more flexible in terms of the worker, not just dictating all the terms as they may have thought they had that power during the pandemic. I think it's going to weaken significantly here. I mean, we're seeing, for example, productivity has plummeted in the last several months. So that just reeks of the fact that we're heading into an earnings recession. You know, part of what I've been saying for some time is that in the last 9 months, stocks and bonds were selling off because of the hiking of interest rates that was happening worldwide. And that was a great shock to the whole financial system because it happened at such a rapid pace. But what hasn't really come into it yet has been this repricing of earnings and profits looking forward. And that's what was really missing. And as I say, when you get into a recession, it's typical to see a 20% plus drop in earnings for corporations. And that is usually the piece that triggers them to say, okay, we're getting a real compression in our margins here. We have to get a lot more efficient. We have to cut overhead. And that's the year-over-year forecast now for Q3 earnings per share is just been reduced to 2.6% from 9.8% expectation in July. So you see, this is this compression of margin, and we'll probably see significantly more of that in Q4 and into 2023. So all of these factors are really working to reverse some of the boom conditions that we saw thanks to the really easy money policies during the pandemic. Like worldwide PC shipments, personal computer shipments, have just fallen in Q3, nearly 20% year over year. That is the steepest decline since the tech wreck 20 years ago. And as I've been writing on the blog, the decline in technology and semiconductor companies, their shares and their profit cycle tends to lead technology, and technology tends to lead the overall markets and economy lower. And we're seeing that in spades right now with the semiconductor index, which is those companies that make the chips, really plunging and making a series of new lows, continuing to do so. So it's off more than 40% now since November, the price of those shares. That's the lowest since July of 2020. And, you know, if you remember, my thesis from the beginning of this has been that that low, that crash low March of 20 was really just a reflex that was bought by the paying forward, if you will, of all these easy money policies. But actually, we were due for a recession in 2019 before COVID hit. So now what we're seeing is a retesting of a lot of leading sectors and weakness coming back to be, you know, at levels we last saw in 2020 and even before that. Just as an example, Canada's standout is, of course, Shopify, which, you know, a year ago was the most highly valued or highly priced company in the TSX composite, and it has fallen 85% since. Now, that doesn't mean that that company is not viable or still valuable or building market share. It means that the free money that was flowing and the speculative fervor that was inflated it beyond anything reasonable. And as we get into this downturn in the global profits structure and in spending and, you know, less tech spending and all that, you're really seeing these things get crushed. And so far, we still haven't seen any capitulation selling, really, to speak of on the equity side. It's been a very kind of measured trounce down over the last 9 months. But we have recently taken out the prior lows in many metrics and sectors that we follow closely. So Candace TSX, for example, you know, we always lag the U.S. indices. That's very typical. We saw that in the 2000 and 2008 cycles where our market rallied later than went after the high was in the U.S. markets, and that's because of our commodities exposure and our bank exposure, that being the bulk of our index by far, those two sectors together. But those sectors ultimately, although they peaked later than the U.S. indices and the technology index like the NASDAQ, they then proceeded to follow it down. And that's what we took out this week, very importantly, lows on the NASDAQ, on the semiconductors, and the TSX, very interestingly, finally broke below its previous July low. So now we're only a few percent barely above where it was just before COVID in February 2019. And, you know, the next test, though, is if we break through 18,000, which we're just basically there right now, you know, below 17,944, which was the high, as I say, pre-COVID. From there, you have a horrifying 39% drop just to get back to the March 20 lows. So I think we're very early in this cycle for the real estate downturn, for the employment and layoffs picture that's coming, for the compression in earnings that's coming, and for the wake-up call for people who are still holding on to equities. We've still got, you know, we've had some coming down from an all-time high in terms of equity exposure last year, but we're still, you know, the average portfolio is still over 60% exposed to equities at this point. A capitulation low in a cycle is typically less than 40. So we've just got so many things that suggest to us, not only that, but as I've mentioned before, central banks, we don't see a bottom in stock markets or the recession or the economic cycle until we've had central banks back to cutting rates. And typically there's a span of several months between the pause and the going back to cutting. So, you know, to think about that, although we're off significantly more than 25%, the worst, you know, in the first 9 months of a year, in many decades, what people fail to appreciate, I think, is that not only are we a pause in back to cutting, which would be necessary historically to start to see a bottom in these asset prices, but central banks are so far still intent on hiking. And it's even if they get to a hike in November and say that's the last of what they end up doing because something breaks or the recession gets very negative and there's a cry for them to stop finally, what you're likely to see is, as I say, this deterioration of all the factors I've talked about for many months after that. And often they, you know, even if they go back to hiking rates, you're not going to see a recovery. I'm sorry, go back to cutting rates, you're not going to see a recovery in these asset prices typically for many months after that. So I think, you know, we're in the early days here, and people need to be really eyes wide open, have a protective strategy for what savings they do have. You know, I've said till I'm blue in the face, they should have used low rates to pay down debt. It's still not too late to do that. You know, if you've got money in these markets that's, you know, losing by the day and you've got debt, you know, you can still take some cash and pay down the debt. You should deleverage your balance sheet so that you're not overexposed. You need to have longevity to get through this next year or so as the economy turns down and all these factors come to manifest. You know, as I say, the bust is deserved by the boom that preceded it. So sadly, as painful as this is, it's something that people should have seen coming and can protect and prepare for. So it's not too late to take steps. Obviously, it would have been better to be proactive, you know, last year and coming into this, but I still think we're not nearly through the depths of the downside that you could see here, the repricing, especially on things like real estate and equities. Now, interestingly, on the bond market side, we've had the worst bond sell-off since 1920 already, right? And historically, that is one of the few asset classes. Investment-grade bonds are the one of the only asset classes that actually tend to bottom in their sell-off before central banks go back to cutting rates. So it could very well be that we're in that range now, and at this point, yields are, you know, the most attractive we've seen since 2007. So there's a huge incentive to be on the fixed income side at this point. The upside looking forward, as central banks start to cut again, those bonds typically rally sharply in that environment, and they're about the only thing that does while all this other stuff mean reverts. So, you know, that's kind of the bright side. The upside is that there's a good prospect that we've seen the lows in the bond market here, that you should see gains if central banks go back to cutting in 2023. And, you know, cash is now actually yielding something when you keep it on the sidelines, so that's very attractive. The rate of change in inflation is coming down. That's very attractive. So there's lots of things that are good about this environment, but only if you think the opposite of what you're being taught or told constantly by the mainstream.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, everybody's piling into the U.S. dollar. It keeps climbing. But how long before this fixed-wing device hits its stalling point, its maximum altitude? What happens then, and do we know when that could happen?
Well, it's a cycle, for sure. And, you know, I know that, again, whatever's happened lately is what people think will happen indefinitely. So we always have to be mindful that it is typical during hiking cycles when central banks tighten that there's a suction of liquidity out of all the other currencies, risk currencies, emerging markets, commodities, all that stuff. It's typical to see the flows come back out of that. So this has been an epic cycle, you know, with the, as I say, the pace of hikes in the last 9 months has been three times higher than we've seen in a couple of decades. Three times faster, I mean, the pace of hikes. So that's really caught a lot of these markets off guard, and you've seen this flooding into U.S.-based assets and U.S. dollars, U.S. Dollars in particular. So now we're back at, you know, 20-year highs. More than that, against many of the world's trading partners, like the yen, the yuan, the British pound, of course, the Aussie dollar is very low. It's even lower than the Canadian dollar, relative to the U.S. dollar. So all these, this trend is very typical. The U.S. dollar index as a benchmark peaked out around 119 in the 2000. one recession before, you know, eventually the thing turns, right? Once you've seen liquidation selling and then all of a sudden prices are really low again and there starts to be like a reboot in the system, and you tend to see then money coming back out of the U.S. dollar and back into some of these riskier assets, which have become less risky as they finally drop so much in price. They become very attractive as an investment opportunity for those that have cash to put to work. So, again, you know, before the 21 peak of 119, we hadn't seen anything higher than the current level until like the mid-80s. So it is quite an anomaly to be this high for the U.S. dollar index. That said, if we're still going to see some tightening for a couple more months and potentially, you know, dislocation and disruption and all these other risk assets, I wouldn't say that we're necessarily through the end of the dollar bull cycle here, but anything sort of around here to 120 is pretty toppy looking. Relative to the Canadian dollar, which matters more to Canadians in particular, you know, again, the U.S. dollar trading at 138 or so against the CAD is getting up there. We've had a sort of a 140 to 145 max upside target this cycle. If we got there, we'd have to reevaluate whether it might go to 150, but, you know, we're getting into kind of rarefied air in around there. And the other thing I've really noticed that I think people should be very careful about is that, again, when the U.S. dollar has been rising and everything else has been falling here, that people really love that. I get it. It's a huge diversity benefit in portfolios, and our portfolios have benefited from a rising U.S. dollar allocation this year, so that's great. But people should be very careful not to have money they have earmarked for a liability payment. So, for example, if you have a mortgage coming due or a debt that you wish to pay, and you've got that money, say it's a Canadian-based liability, and you've got that money in the U.S. dollar or any other currency, frankly, you're taking on a currency risk that you need to be very mindful of, right? You should ideally have your liabilities matched with the currency in which you pay them. Just be cautious, because I'm just cautioning people not to, you know, think, well, I'm not going to, for example, pay off that debt in Canadian dollars because I want to keep my money in the U.S. dollar, which is rising. At some point here, that trade is going to go against you, and you're still going to have the liability. So I always say, you know, where possible, get the liabilities paid down and off, ideally, and then start worrying about your savings, being long-term savings, investment savings, that sort of thing, once you're free and clear. And that is just a really strong foundation to have to help you get through these economic cycles and market cycles.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Check out her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com and we'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.